Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to The Shift, the podcast that aims to tell the no-holds-barred truth about being a woman post 40, created and hosted by me, writer and broadcaster Sam Baker. The last time Annie McManus came on The Shift, she was about to make a massive shift. Then in her early 40s, one of the country's biggest female DJs was on the brink of walking away. The prescribed way of doing things, climbing, climbing, climbing until you were Johnny Big Balls, as she put it, was not for her. Like so many women at this life stage, she wants to find a new way to build her own decks. Since then, Annie, now 45, has written two novels, the latest of which is The Mess We're In, out now in paperback. She's helmed two hit podcasts and launched the so fabulous I Can't Believe Nobody Thought of It Before Club Night, Before Midnight, aimed at those of us who love to dance but don't want to stay up till 3 a.m. to do it. Hands up if you're in.
If you're one of those people who, like me, found going for manicures really annoying and time-consuming when I could just do it at home, badly, but still just do it at home, same with huge skincare routine or any of that stuff, you don't have to do that stuff. You can go around and have no nail varnish on and you'll still have a great day.
Annie joined me for one of those conversations that goes all the places. We discussed the emotional upheaval of leaving a big, huge, enormous job after 17 years and how she rediscovered who she was when she wasn't Annie off the radio. Plus, the loneliness of working from home, the hormonal chaos of perimenopause, the scary urge to set fire to something, how to make new friends in your 40s, getting back on the football pitch, and leaning into who she really is now she no longer has to waste time getting manicures. So where are you? Are you in your shed again or are you somewhere else this time?
I'm actually upstairs in a little kind of multi-purpose room, which I use as a gym mostly. But there's also a desk in here because I have people working in the garden, banging and drilling, and it's not going to be good for this. So I moved temporarily up here. I spend most of my time in this room on my beloved Peloton and doing weights. And yeah, I kind of have commandeered it for exercise.
When did the exercise?
The Peloton.
Yeah, all of it. Were you always an exerciser?
I've always been an exerciser, always. And I've gone through many different phases of exercising, but this Peloton, my husband bought secondhand off someone for his own studio, which I just thought was hilarious. He's a music producer, so I kind of imagined him on the bike, you know, listening to like mixed downs or whatever on his Peloton. But it didn't last long, and then he said he would take it home. Yeah, I have just fallen in love with it. It's amazing. I love that thing. I love the fact that it's in the house. I don't have to go anywhere. I open the window, I get all my fresh air. I can do weights, I can do yoga, I can do boxing, I can do dancing, I can obviously do lots of cycling. You do it on and off the bike, but it just really suits where I am in my life right now, and that my hours are so precious in the day because I essentially work in school hours. To have to go somewhere to exercise takes up too much time. So the fact that I could just do it in my house and do half an hour first thing, it really sets me up for the day. And my attitudes to exercise have completely changed as well, in that I am so interested in exercise for how it makes me feel mentally and how it helps me work and keeps me sharp focused and allows me to have ideas. It's ticking so many boxes that it's always ticked, but I think I'm much more aware of the more cerebral ones as opposed to the physical ones.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I think I was definitely, I got to be honest, I was all about the weight loss
when it came to exercise. That was the point of it. And I do have slightly a debit credit mentality still, I have to admit. Yeah, the kind of just going for a walk and feeling so much better afterwards.
Also, like, I've started doing with the Peloton loads of weights, and I've never really got fully into weights before. And God, it feels good to be strong. Mm. It feels so nice to be strong and to, you know, I've never given a shit about my core. I didn't understand that because to me that's like inside. So, you know, like you, it was like, well, you're not going to notice it. So what's the point?
Exactly.
So I've spent a lot of time working on my core and again, just feeling strong from the inside out. It feels really nice. I really want to keep doing more. And I feel as I get older, more of a desire to kind of push my body and see what it can do, you know, and see how far it can maybe run or cycle, or, you know, maybe it's a midlife crisis. I don't know, Sam. Yeah. I know that a lot of women end up doing triathlons around my age. Yeah. Who knows?
It is. I think it is a midlife thing. Control or just wanting to take something for you or, yeah. I mean, I definitely, particularly the weights thing, actually. I used to do weights before lockdown. I haven't actually got back into it, which is a mistake. But I haven't, since I moved up here during that time, I found somewhere to do Pilates, but I never found somewhere that did the weights in the same way. And I'm not very good at being self-motivating. We'll talk about this as well. I'm not very good at being self-motivating. So the kind of whole Peloton thing, how do you do yoga and weights related to the Peloton?
So there's a mat. Here, so you
this
do,
is not
you,
an ad for Peloton, by the way.
No, definitely
money has
not.
Changed hands.
Definitely not. There's a mat beside it, and the Peloton, you know, it's basically an entire library of workouts with gym with instructors and trainers. And so, yeah, they tell you to get off the bike, get on, you know. So you are, it's like having a trainer in your room, and loads of what they do is not on the bike. So that's the bit that's been a revelation for me because I'd get well bored on the bike. I like a bit, I like diversifying my exercise.
Yeah, because I thought it was just, I just assumed it was just bike.
Mm. Oh. It's vast, yeah, what you can do.
Interesting. Yeah. So tell me, what was day one like after you'd left your enormous job and you were, what were you doing? Were you writing the book?
At the end of July.
Oh, it was school holidays then.
So it was school holidays. It took a while. There was a lot of huge emotions upon leaving. I think I was surprised at the reaction because it seemed to affect people in a way where they took it very personally because my time there, of which it was 17 years, well, if people had been listening for that long, which a lot of people had, it felt like a very stark reminder that time has passed and time marches on. And I think people seem to be quite emotional about it. And I don't think that was about me per se. I think it was about what me leaving represented to them, which was making them look back at their life and realizing how much had changed. And there was an element of when I left feeling like I had died somehow as well, because of everyone kind of did all these tributes, which was lovely, but it was also quite strange because I was like, I'm still here. And then the actual leaving was just so perfect. And I'm still so grateful that my last show went as smoothly as it did and everything just clicked into place. And yeah, I kind of said this line at the end of my show, which was a kind of interpolation of a lyric from a Gladys Knight song, which is, if you like the music, get up and dance. And people really seem to like that. And for me, it felt like fitting because it was like, I want to keep engaging in life and I want to keep trying new things and I want to keep learning and all of that stuff. I was really, really excited about being a writer and I was still doing my podcast and I kind of launched myself into both of those things. I was still doing shows, still gigging. So life did carry on as normal in a way. I spent a long time just feeling very, very excited about not being at work in weekday evenings, just having all this time to be around and to engage with my family or that kind of thing. So everything that I hoped from leaving definitely kind of came through. there was a period about a year after I left where I think everything came to a head a little bit in terms of the life that I had chosen, the way that I had chosen to work, which was being a writer, as we know, is hugely solitary. You're in your own head all day. You're rattling around the house. I work from home. My podcast is also, as yours is, I presume, mostly on Zoom. The producer that I work with lives in Edinburgh. So there's not a lot of like face-to-face meetups. You know, you're doing everything virtually, which is amazing that you can. But equally, that kind of face-to-face human connection, I found that I was really lacking. And I had a period of 2 or 3 months at the autumn of 2022 that I really got a bit of a fright, actually, in that I started, I don't know, I can't really describe it. I felt really, really restless, insatiated somehow. And I had all this kind of nervous energy and nowhere to put it. And I was at home all day. And I realized I didn't really have any connections in my local area beyond like a couple of school mums. I didn't feel rooted to my community at all. And one of the things that had happened upon leaving Radio One was it's like if you're holding a balloon and you let it go, I felt so giddy with freedom for the possibilities of what I could do and where I could go. I could live abroad. I could, you know, I don't have to be in one place anymore. I don't have a boss for the first time since I was 17 and had bar jobs. Like I've always had a boss. So all these kind of, this kind of new liberation made me think of how I could live my life. And one of the things I kept thinking about was moving back home to Ireland, really fixated on whether that was the right thing to do. And I realized upon, you know, in this kind of struggle of choice, like, should I do it? Should I not? Should I do it? That my local community was something that I'd never invested in. And I think I hadn't invested in it because I'd always in the back of my head thought, I'll probably move back to Ireland sometime. Or I was just too busy wrapped up in my own life. So suddenly I was kind of confronted with lots more time, which is great. That's what I wanted. But a kind of a sense of floundering. Floundering is the word I always come back to when I talk about that period, because I didn't really know who I was. There's a sense of an identity crisis as well when you leave Radio One, where you're so neatly defined. You're out of that and you have to rediscover who you are. Who you are when you're not, you know, hiding behind exciting new music, you know, when you're not being that conduit on the radio. So there was a real sense of, I don't know really what I want, where I want to be. I don't really know who I am fully in the way that being rooted somewhere gives you. Yeah, I was just a bit miserable. And then that on top of like being at home all day, I was lonely. And it took me a long time to actually accept that word. It's a big old word. It's a big old word that, thank you. And it is something that I didn't feel like I had a right to claim. You know, I had a family, I had friends who I didn't see much anymore, but I had friends. I was very lucky. I was privileged. I had a house, I had jobs, you know, all of this stuff. But I think it was a really big and important wake-up call for me, because I had to realize what I needed as a person to feel like I was okay. And one of those things that I had at Radio One that really served me with, that I didn't have now, was a sense of collaboration, a sense of seeing people and having genuine human connections. I'm an extrovert. I need to be around people. I'm fed by that. And I'd forgotten that. Also, forgotten is the wrong word, because I hadn't had to even realize, because I always had it. So upon it being taken away, I had to look at myself and go, okay, you need this. That was cool. In a way, like it wasn't fun at the time. And I thought I was going mental. I thought I was going mad. I do think now, looking back at that time, that there was a sense of there was hormones involved 100% that were really exacerbating these feelings. And I felt like little weird things that I hadn't felt before, like really chronic itchiness. Itchy head, itchy legs. I know that this is perimenopausal. I didn't then. So there was all these things happening that I wasn't able to join the dots with. But it was definitely some sort of a hormonal flare up, then coupled with all the other things of kind of identity crisis, being alone all day. It was a lot. And it took a while to process what it all meant. And only it was a good while after that I was able to write about it and really kind of realize what it was. And upon writing the piece, which I did for The Guardian, I had such a huge reaction from people getting in touch with me saying that they also felt lonely for their reasons. And I guess the nice irony of that is that you feel less alone upon sharing your loneliness. But I've had to change how I work as a result of that happening. And one of the things I was determined to do was A, make up my mind once and for all whether I was going to move to Ireland so that I wasn't in this kind of limbo. And I wasn't always thinking, what if, you know, because you have to at some point just commit to where you are in your life. And I decided to commit to London. So that was it felt like a relief in a way. The other thing was changing the fact that I was alone all day at home. I got a cat.
I thought you were a dog person.
I mean, I have to apologize to cats all over the world. I was catist. I didn't really feel like they were my vibe. I thought they were very imperious and, you know, self-serving and all of that. But we've got very lucky with our cat and she's very sociable. And it's just remarkable how having a sentient thing in the house with you just makes such a difference. So that was a lovely thing. It's also a female. I live with two boys and a man. So it's nice to have some female energy.
What's the cat called?
Minnie, yeah.
I totally get that. We've got a cat, Sausage, as regular listeners will know, because he usually puts in an appearance at some point. But he is a combination of incredibly sociable, because he was a rescue cat, so he's a total hustler. So very, very self-serving in a very endearing way.
No, I can't quite get over her. I feel like we're very lucky to have her and everyone adores her in our house. So that really kind of, in a very quiet way, made a difference to my days. I was able to talk to her as opposed to myself.
Yes. Yeah. I know exactly what you mean.
The other thing was I had an opportunity to work with my friend Nick Grimshaw at the BBC. And I've been very kind of loath to take on any new work because I felt quite overloaded already. But to have an opportunity to go into town every day, wear a nice outfit, go into the BBC, work with a team and sit and chat with Nick Grimshaw for a couple of hours every week about music was so perfect for what I needed. And now I do that once a week. The podcast is called Sidetracked. It just serves me so well. So all those things that I needed are now there and it's nice and neat and it's half a day and it's all the boxes ticked. So that's been great. And then the other thing I've done is try really hard to get a bit more rooted in my community. I've realized that this, especially in the last 6 months, I'm 45 now. So since turning 45 last summer, I have done a strange kind of regression where I've come full circle on some things that I've always kind of wanted to do and never had the time or the headspace to figure out how to do them. And each one of those, there's three things, and each one of them are things that I haven't done since I was in school. So the first one is I've started learning Irish again, wow, which is what I did up to when I was 17. It's compulsory in Ireland to learn Irish. It's the national language. And I haven't used it or touched it since then. So I've been learning that and I've been doing that for nearly a year now. And it's been so good because I've been so worried about my memory and the fact that my memory is just getting shitter and shitter. And again, I think that's perimenopausal.
That is perimenopause, yeah.
But it's also 15 years of very little sleep and it's always been bad. So it's getting even worse. So I just wanted to see if my brain still had this information that I'd remembered, that I'd learned when I was 17, does it disappear altogether? Or is there a way I can access it? Is there doors I can open to find this stuff again? And what it taught me is that, yes, it's all still there, buried deep. And I just needed to find it, like a way to access it again. So I was so relieved that I still knew lots of the stuff, lots of the Irish language. And I was just kind of refreshing it. So that was great. And then the other thing I've done, and this is with regards to the community, is I've joined a choir.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's been, oh my God, such a revelation. I have loved it. It's a local choir, all sorts of people. It's quite small. There's something so lovely about standing in a room with, you know, 20 other people and all singing the same song. And it's so primal, but it just ticks off so many boxes because, first of all, you're concentrating on what you're singing and you're concentrating on your parts. So you cannot allow any other thoughts in. You're focusing. It consumes your brain.
It's a meditative way.
The act of singing, the physical act of singing, is really nice for your body. And thirdly, the collective act of singing, like with people, you know, I don't understand the science of it. I don't understand what it does to you or your brain, but it is without a doubt it feels healing. It feels meditative. You come away from there and you feel calmer, happier every week. I've really, really enjoyed that. We did a little Christmas show in the local school hall before Christmas and, it was a proper buzz. Like it was really nice. And then the third thing, and this is really recent, this has only happened in the last 2 weeks, is that I have got really into playing football again.
Wow.
So when I was in primary school, I was football mad. I was like the girl on the guys' team. I was always into it. And then when I started secondary school, they didn't have football for girls there. They had hockey. So I got really into hockey. And then I never got back into playing football, and my son is 10 and he's mad into football. So I've been playing with him now and again, just kicking it about and the odd time coaching his team, his local team. I did that last year because I was so incensed that all the coaches were men and 99% of the community football players were boys, that I was like, they need to see a female coach. So I did that a little bit. In doing all of that, I realized how much I loved playing football and always felt like for some reason I wouldn't be able to go back. I went to an over 40s football session last week.
Wow. I didn't know those existed. That's brilliant.
I know. It's a club in East London called Gold Diggers. Great name. They had an over 40s session, which I was shitting it about and went to, and just again, like the Irish, it was such a relief to know that my body knew what to do. It felt so good and exhausting. It's really high intensity exercise, but I just loved it. I loved the camaraderie. I loved all the other women. There was women of all ages. There was women in their 60s. There was beginners.
Is it a female club?
It was female. Yeah, it's female and, well, all inclusive. So, you know, a lot of people who are non-binary as well. But just really a lovely, inclusive atmosphere. And then I got so into that. And then they told me that they only train kind of 4 or 5 times a year. So I was a bit like, oh, I kind of want to do it all the time now.
Yeah.
And T, my husband, had made friends with a nanny in one of my kids' friends' nannies. And he told me that she was a baller and she was an ex-football player. And I should ask her if there's any local teams. So she brought me to a local session last week with a proper team, you know, who are women in their 20s and 30s, which was even scarier.
Yeah,
because this was the real deal. But I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And it's kind of awakened something in me where I suppose I always felt like I'd gone too far past a certain point to go back to playing football again. And it's been so lovely to realize that I can still do that. And I'm just trying not to focus on my age and trying not to get injured and just play because I want to and because it feels good.
It's interesting because there's so much of an idea that, you know, once you're your age, my age, that, you know, new things or rediscovering old things is not a possibility. And it's just so untrue. So untrue.
It's so untrue. And I think especially with sport, I find it so sad. So many women in sport, they quit in puberty. It's so sad. And I think there's an element of thinking that you have to be competitive or you have to compete in sports, and you can just do it for fun and you can be terrible at it and that's okay. And I think the more we can encourage women to do sport that way for fun and to be awful at it and just to enjoy it for the sake of it, I think is good. All these women who were with me at the over 40s thing, they were brilliant. And they were, it's just a matter of the door being opened for them and for people to feel welcome in that world.
Yeah, because we couldn't play football when I was at school. And now when I walk past all the little girl teams playing on, I feel so much joy from those little girls covered in mud and, you know, the studs of their boots all clogged up. And just, I think it was so, I was so pissed off that I wasn't allowed at that age. And it does feel, it feels like it's getting better, but I don't, you're right. You don't see many women on the sideline except for some mums. Don't see many mum coaches.
Not at all. Not at all. And when there's no female coaches, then the girls don't feel like, you know, you need to see that happening more on every level. But yeah, you're right. It is changing. But, you know, I brought my son to see my friend Monkey yesterday, who's a DJ, and she's also a really good footballer. She plays for Dulwich Hamlet. And we went to go see them playing Fulham Ladies yesterday. And it's the first ladies football game I've ever been to, which is embarrassing. And it's the first time my son's seen it and his friend as well. And it was such a vibe. It was so fun. And the stands, even the atmosphere at the games are different. It's way less aggy. There's more, it's more of a family feel. It's very, very fun. I mean, it's obviously, you know, male football is fun too, but there's a kind of, I don't know, there's a sense of togetherness, I think, and a sense of a more kind of family celebratory atmosphere at the women's games, which I think a lot of people remark on.
My dad and my granddad used to have a season ticket to, don't judge me, Southampton. That's where I come from.
You know, no judgment.
It's not, they're not the most, you know, the easiest team to support, but hey, we stick with them. And when my dad couldn't go because he was going to work at the weekend, I used to get his season ticket and go with my granddad. And it was, you know, even like a family club like that. And we're talking like the mid to late 70s. You know, I learned the word wanker on the, you know, on the stands at the Dell and every other really bad word as well.
Oh, yeah.
And that kind of, that aggression.
Yeah.
It's really associated with football, isn't it?
It really is, yeah. The women a lot of the time get as involved as the men in that scenario. I think a lot of the time it's a way for people to express themselves in a safe environment where they don't get to do that in real life. And it's, you get the same thing at a football match as I do at a choir session. You know, it's that kind of collective experience of joy and pain, and it's so important. This is, you know, when I was researching loneliness, and you know, that is such a huge part of the human experience, is to experience things collectively. And the way that we live now, it's, everything has become so pointing towards individualism in terms of, you know, it's so rarely that we have appointment to watch television where we all watch the same thing at the same time, or, you know, the way we consume media, music, anything. So things like football matches they're so important for us as a species to go and feel that sense of togetherness you get. So yeah, I'm all for them, but I'm just very excited about women's football at the moment. I think, I just think if I can get more women over 40 into it, like my dream is to have to properly play in a league or something, but I don't know if I'm brave enough to play competitively at the moment. I'll just stay training.
Yeah, it's like, you've definitely made me think, oh, maybe I'll investigate that a bit and see if there are any options for that up here, because that is, playing football is something I assumed was only an option for younger women. Definitely. I mean, I don't tend to let my age stop me doing things, but I definitely would have thought that football wasn't going to be welcoming me at my great age. The whole loneliness thing is so interesting, because what you were saying about, you know, you give up that big job. And I did the same thing. And you just don't really think about all the things that you're giving up. You think about when you're doing it, you think about the time that you're getting back. And like you say, it's so exciting about all the potential ahead of you. And then nobody tells you the reality of working on your own, particularly if you're a writer, when it really is all in your head and you have to be totally self-motivating. And like I said, I'm really not very good at that. I really need the deadline, you know? And that's one of the things that the podcast gives me, is it's, here's a thing that I have to do every week.
Yeah. Yeah. It's great. It gives you a sense of structure. Yeah.
But the other thing that, yeah, so the structure's gone, the status is gone, and nobody really, I certainly didn't really want to admit how much of me was my job, and it was a huge amount. And then also it's how central our jobs are to our friend making. And it's really hard to make friends when you're in your 40s and 50s and you don't have either the school gate or the office to create. So how did you go about kind of making new friends?
I had a set of friends that all, you know, from COVID kind of splintered into various parts of the country, and everyone, you know, is obviously busy and stressed and has loads of shit on. So it's kind of like your friendships during and after COVID, a lot of them moved online and went to WhatsApp and kind of stayed on WhatsApp. And there was a realization that you have entire friendships that only exist on WhatsApp, and that WhatsApp does is it very sneakily makes you feel like your friendships are still healthy because you're chatting a lot, but you're not actually seeing people face to face. That face to face connection is what is so important when it comes to loneliness, because you could have 30 friends on WhatsApp that you speak to every week, but until you're actually seeing people face to face and having, having improvised interactions, you know, where you're seeing facial expressions and you're feeling people's, you know, energy and you're touching hands or whatever, that stuff is so crucial. So I realized that I was going to have to try and make some more friends that were accessible to me, that were local, that I could call on and have a pint with, you know, within an hour if I needed to. And I'd never really embraced the school mom thing. I had a couple of friends that I really loved, and I didn't really, I kind of shied away from the whole, school mom thing. I felt quite like I didn't have the time or the headspace to deal with it. And I was kind of in and out on the school runs and didn't really engage with it too much. So made an effort to try and do that. And I kind of messaged a couple of four or five people who I thought were lovely and would love to get to know a bit more, and kind of suggested a night in the pub, and it went really well. And we kind of all admitted that we would like to do it more often. And we now have a very rough kind of schedule in place where we try and go to the pub every couple of weeks and catch up. And it's such a small thing, but it really does make the world of difference to know that you have a little gang near you locally that you can lean on and call on. You know, that was a really big move for me. Weirdly, it shouldn't feel like that, but it was. And it had a big effect on me. And the other thing that I did was I discovered my local Irish pub. And that is ridiculous because I walk past it every day on the way to school. But I hadn't really been in it that much. And I had to go in it because I ended up interviewing the landlady there, who's an amazing woman, for my most recent novel, of which a lot is set in an Irish pub. And going in there and getting to know her was really strangely profound as well, because the more I went in there, the more I felt a kinship with the people that were in there. And it's a brilliantly typical Irish pub. There is no frills at all, you know, strip lighting, no nice candles, no food, just, you know, it's very basic. But it acts, I suppose, as a kind of community center for an entire layer of local people that I'd never accessed before. They are, most of them, Irish abroad, and they're a complete motley crew. But getting to know those people and being able to walk into a pub and say hello to people and buy a pint for someone or have a pint bought for you, like, it's so small, but that makes such a difference to that feeling of belonging. And to feeling like you, just that you belong where you are. And there's a lot to be said for why there's Irish pubs all over the world. And I get it, because when you live abroad, you have this sense of never being Irish enough to live in Ireland again, because I've lived in London for 25 years, but also always being a foreigner in London. Now, it's easy to be a foreigner in London because it's a city made up of foreigners, you know, but there's still a sense of otherness. When you go there, what you're confronted with is lots of people who are like you, who are kind of in the middle of things, neither here nor there. And there's a loveliness in feeling at home with them. So that place and discovering that place and going to that place has made a real difference to me as well, in just feeling like I'm more rooted in my local area. And I have kind of friends that I can call on, not close friends, you know, but just if I could go down there on my own with my book and feel comfortable, which is a lovely feeling.
I think it's one of those things when you've got one of those jobs, like your job, where your entire social life revolves around your work. And certainly you live in London, but everybody converges kind of in the middle or wherever the work is. So you only really, certainly I felt that you only really realized how far away everybody was when I stopped going into work in an office. It could be like a 4-hour round trip to have a cup of coffee with somebody. And I think once we moved up here, I mean, the first time a friend, it was after lockdown had started to lift and pubs and bars were open, but, you know, sitting outside and things. The first time somebody texted me and said, I've so had it with work today. Do you want to go for a drink? And I was like, yeah. And she was like, see you in 20 minutes. And I was like, oh my God. Oh my God.
That was the dream.
It's completely new.
Yeah.
To me, because of the way I'd lived my life.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you really can't underestimate how living in a city can, how hard it is to stay connected. And it's such a contradiction in terms. You're surrounded by people, but it can feel like you're going to Brighton and back to meet a friend in London. It's unbelievable. My best friend lives in West Ham. It takes an hour door to door. So it's 2 hours every time I want to see her.
And you're in North London, aren't you?
I'm in Northwest London, yeah. So the opposite end of London, yeah. So it's a real hard struggle to maintain friendships, and you have to be really invested in them and really, you know, really want them to work in order to do that. And I think it happens naturally as we grow older anyway. We have friends that fall away naturally. And I think it's really, there's something to be said for that. I think it's important to kind of, to be able to appreciate a friendship while it lasted, and also appreciate when it's over, and you know, just be glad it happened and not feel like a friendship ending is necessarily a failure. There's friendships that can really, you know, work for you at certain periods of your life. I've felt like after leaving Radio One and where I am now, it was really interesting, I suppose, to kind of really see who my real friends were when you take away the status and when you take away the perks and the free guest lists and the, you know, all of that stuff, who's there at the end of it. So my friendship group has got much smaller, but then I have been forced then to look at myself and figure out who I want to be and what type of person I am and what do I need. And in doing that, it's helped me get a different type of friendship group, much more varied in age, all sorts of people. Yeah, it's much more diverse. I like that.
How much, I mean, you mentioned your hormones earlier. How much do you think, with the benefit of hindsight, do you think your hormones and what you were kind of on the cusp of going through played into that whole experience?
I don't think my hormones played into it that much, if I'm really honest. I think it was if they did, it was unconscious, like it was subconscious on my part. I wouldn't have been aware of them playing a role. The first time I really felt my hormones affect my life in a way was that period at the end of 2022, when I felt that kind of very floundering, restless and kind of a new type of loneliness. So I don't think it really played into the leaving. I don't think it did in terms of how I would be aware of it. Yeah.
In the loneliness piece, which I'll actually pop the link in the show notes, if anybody wants to read it, it's really, really good. There's a moment where you say you wanted to set fire, metaphorically, you wanted to set fire to things. And I think that would resonate. I mean, I literally went, yes, when I read that, because I think that so many women at this age and stage and feel that, have that feeling where they just want to put a bomb under it.
So I was recording a podcast with a friend of mine, Sophie Haywood, an amazing writer and woman. And I said that line out loud to her, and it it kind of scared me. I was like, whoa, where did that come from? But it really rang true to how I was feeling. I don't know where it came from. And yeah, now that you say that, it's definitely that, that is definitely something to do with hormones, but it's also a sense of, I don't know, maybe like a, there's frustration in there. I don't know what it is. It's kind of like, yeah, a sense of just wanting to turn the table over, you know, just flip the table over and do something drastic and move to the other side of the world and just lean into the shadows and the dark sides of life and just push yourself. And I don't know, just there's, you spend so long, don't you? You spend so long just trying to hold it together for everyone around you and yourself. I don't know. I think what that line was kind of way of trying to articulate a kind of subversion of that, like a kind of need to subvert it, a need to try and stop having to be the one that is responsible with all the answers, with all the right decisions. Stop feeling like you have to compare your life to everything. Stop feeling like you have to live by the rules that society decides that you should live by as a woman in your 40s. Like there's so many things going on in that one little sentence, but I feel that still, but it's way less extreme than it was. And I know I'm very sure that that will come back. And I think, I don't know, you may know more than me, Sam, but I feel like that was a little taste of a menopausal moments. And I think it will come again. I am really interested in that whole side of menopause and that whole side of growing older as a woman. And I was reading this article by Miranda July in Vogue, which I thought was amazing. She was talking about how, you know, as women, we have a template of how we're supposed to live and look and act from when we're really young. And then you get to middle age and there's nothing because you don't see women of a certain age out there in films. You know, you don't really, you've got no rule book for how to exist. And you have this huge, you know, menopause word hanging over you, which, you know, I'm at the kind of precipice of it. And part of me is kind of like, I'm kind of scared of it, but I'm also quite excited about it because I feel like it's going to send me places and I'm kind of down for that, she says. I mean, I'll wait and see what it does really, but I do think that there's, personally, I feel I don't know who I'm going to be. And I think that's really exciting me in a way. And I want to be as open to change as possible. And I want to keep surprising myself what I'm realizing, kind of zooming out on how I have changed in the last couple of years, even since leaving Radio One, is that leaning into who I am now is a lovely feeling, not being ashamed of my age, not feeling any way about it, just embracing being 45 and trying not to listen to any stereotypes or any like rules of society for how I should be. Before midnight, the club night I made up was a really kind of confidence building process with that regard, in that it allowed me to be very confident in who I was and what I needed, and to still want to go clubbing and still experience clubbing, but do it in a way that suited me, and do it so that it ended at midnight. And the reaction to that was so overwhelmingly positive, and the people that come to it are so overwhelmingly female, and it's like 75% women, and it's made me feel so empowered to make choices for myself and not fit into the boxes that society has told me I should fit into. And you know what else? This is the other thing. I know you emailed me about the Nivea TikTok thing.
Yeah, I've been sitting here looking at your amazing glowing skin.
So I honestly feel like, and this is like a slow dawning realization that we've been so duped. Women in society, it's such a fucking trap. Like at every level of how we are supposed to exist, we are being held back from the starting line and made to wait longer to proceed through life in a way that we want to. Heels, What the fuck are they about? Why, who decided that women should have to wear heels? It's literally the biggest handicap you can have. And if it's, you can't move with your body, it's unnatural. Makeup. What the fuck is that about? Why is it such a given that women have to cover their faces with makeup? All that, like the group, like the amount of time that women spend grooming. If you could spend that time doing, learning, fucking qualifying, you know, I don't know, whatever, just reading a book. Like, it just makes me furious, the amount of things that are expected of women that hold them back from whatever they want to do. And listen, if you love, I love lipstick. I will always wear red lipstick. I'm not trying to denounce anyone who wants to feel like they look nice. But if you're one of those people who, like me, found going for manicures really annoying and time consuming when I could just do it at home badly, but still just do it at home. Same with, you know, like a huge skincare routine or any of that stuff. I just don't have time. And I feel quite passionately that you don't have to do that stuff. You can go around and have no nail varnish on and you'll still have a great day.
Yeah, it's all that stuff. Just feels like it's about consuming our time and energy and money, so we're not using it on something.
It's like a trick. It's like someone's been like, haha, we got them there. We've got them to spend all of their money. The skin stuff is just, I mean, I find it really overwhelming when I start getting into like what I should be putting on my skin and not. It's so vast and don't have the time or the headspace to really do enough research to know about it. But all I know is that I genuinely do not believe that most of those creams do anything, or serums or fucking whatever. And I tell you what's good for skin, sleep.
Yeah.
And what's good for skin, water and good food. If you can do that, you'll have good skin. No amount of serums, no amount of creams can change a good diet and a good night's sleep and lots of water. Like, I think we just get tricked so much and our time is like sucked away by kind of Western capitalism. And it fucking, I just feel like I've kind of come up to the surface and I've just suddenly seen it all. And I cannot believe that I've spent so much money and time doing all this stuff that just doesn't matter.
I can't think about what I could have done with the money that I've spent on clothes and skin cream. And, you know, it's so interesting what you were saying just then about the, you know, the kind of the trepidation of menopause, but then the excitement of what comes next. And listening to you talk, you're so already in that zone, because the number of women I speak to are like, you know, I don't care about that stuff anymore. And I'm so much more in touch with the person that I used to be, you know, the person who played football and sang in the choir and learned Irish and didn't waste all their bloody time on manicures. And what's the main difference in Annie McManus now?
I'm very much more connected with who I am, who I was. I've kind of, yeah, there's a sense of having come full circle. And I'm more connected with, you know, with myself, and I've kind of know myself more. I've been forced to know myself more, and I feel more in tune with my feelings and kind of hyper aware of my more just like more aware of my cycle, more aware of my body and what it does for me. Way more grateful for all of that stuff, not taking anything for granted. I think I'm a better mother. I definitely feel more around and engaged and there for my children. Still struggle, like I've always struggled, with a sense of having more work than I would like. But I also think that part of that suits who I am. Way more in control of my life. And that feels really good. And that's every aspect, from my diet to my exercise to the work I want to put out into the world. But most of all, I think it is that I'm my own boss. I had become very much institutionalized in a way, you know, when, you know, always having someone who set an agenda, what I did, And it's been really nice to be able to set my own agenda and to go at the speed that I want to go at, and to slow down in one way, but kind of feel like I've speeded up in other ways, in that I've really, really listened to myself for the first time and had the time and the space to do that. And that feels really nice.
Right. What's your emotional age?
I don't know. I don't know what the answer to that is. I feel like I am the age that I am supposed to be, you know, emotionally now. I feel like my emotional age is my age that I am now. So 45, if that's allowed.
Yeah, totally. Give us a book recommendation.
I am currently reading Afua Hirsch, Decolonizing My Body, which is excellent. Talk about a woman who's gone through a huge upheaval when it comes to everything she's learned with regards to how to be a woman today. She has completely had to unlearn it, and then relearn it. And that's what this whole book's about. It's very pertinent to everything I've been talking about, in that just the sense of realizing that you've been duped somehow, and that there's way and approaches to be a woman than the ones that we are told.
Yeah, I've been desperate to get her on. I'm going to go back to nagging. What advice would you give younger women?
I think it's the hardest thing is to know yourself well enough to know what you want. And that will always change, of course, but it's how can you know yourself? It's constantly trying to do that. It's trying to tune into who you are and what makes you tick and what makes you happy and what makes you inspired, and constantly try and hold on to that. Don't be afraid to question things and to go against the grain, and always do everything that you can to be as connected to yourself as you possibly can. And that can be uncomfortable sometimes. You have to ask questions of yourself that you mightn't want to know the answers to, but it's a process and it's something that can take your whole life. But the more you know who you are, the better decisions you will make for yourself in your life.
Do you wish you'd known yourself better when you were younger?
Yes, there was definitely periods where I should have done things differently, but equally, I feel very lucky that I got through a lot of my early womanhood unscathed, pretty much from decisions that I made. So I don't wish it. I don't regret it. I think I did everything right for who I was at the time, and I wouldn't want to be cross with myself. I just feel relieved.
Yeah.
Real relieved.
Yeah. I know what you mean.
Yeah.
I just would not want to go back to being in my early 20s for anything.
No, it was absolute chaos.
Who's your old bird role model?
How old are we talking?
Just older than you.
My sister, probably. She's 3 years older than me.
Yeah. Not very old bird role model.
I don't know if she'd appreciate being called an old bird, but she is a very fierce person who fights to express herself in a way that she needs to do. She's a performance artist, and she lives in a rural Irish town, and she has 3 children, of which one is differently abled and she is their carer. She has to fight for space and time to do her work, which is very radical where she is. You know, she does really extravagant performance art pieces where she might crawl through the local town at midnight with a head torch on, or walk up and down the waterline of a local beach from the middle of the night to sunrise, you know, until her feet are bleeding. Like, very evocative, you know, amazing art. And I always just think the kind of fearlessness of that, doing stuff like that, in such a, you know, in such an environment that where people are like, who is this woman? What's she doing? Is pretty amazing.
She sounds amazing. What's your superpower?
I think that I am maybe lucky, and I think I got this off my dad, who is one of those people who is so naturally gregarious. You know, he's very comfortable around people, and he really becomes alive around people. I remember as a girl kind of going with him on his messages, you know, wherever he would be going, dropping into people here and dropping stuff off, and just always witnessing him around people and how he was just so naturally able to, just have a conversation with people and have these kind of positive exchanges with people. And I feel like that's the kind of thing that I can do naturally, but also it's something that I genuinely I've noticed it more and more. I'm really in a quite profound way. Like I can be having a pretty shit day and I can go down into the little village where I live. Sounds like I live in the country. I live in London. And I can have an exchange with the guy in the cafe and, you know, with the other guy in the bakery or whatever. And that could literally turn my day around. I love those little exchanges. I love people and connecting with people. So maybe that's my superpower, connecting.
Last one, how many fucks do you give?
Fucking way less than I used to. And it feels amazing. I hope I'll get to the point where I'll be able to say zero, but definitely the fucks are going down.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, you might also like my conversations with Joe Wiley and DJ Paulette. You can hear a new episode of The Shift each Tuesday, wherever you get your podcasts. If you like what you hear, please do rate, review and follow, because it really does help other people find us. And if you'd like more of The Shift in your life, head over to theshiftwithsambaker.substack.com and sign up for weekly newsletters, podcast extras and more.